Thank you, Doug. I'm really pleased to be here, and I appreciate having this opportunity. As Doug says, I am going to talk about some NMR and NQR work we've been doing in lanthanum cuprate. I'd like first to take some time to tell you about the people that have really been crucial to doing this work. And those fall into two categories. The first are three very, very talented and hardworking postdocs that have worked with me over the years. Nick Kuro, who is still at Los Alamos, Byung-Jin Sa, who's now at the Catholic University of Korea, and Yosuke Yoshinari, who's working for the electron microscope company JAL in Japan. Second group of people that have been crucial to this are people that provide us high quality samples. And indeed, the samples have been of extremely high quality. That's been very important. I particularly want to acknowledge Ben Bruckner's involvement in this. We've collaborated for a long time now, and I've really valued his input over those years. He's a great guy. So I'm going to be talking about NMR and QR measurements. NMR couples to spin, and what I'm going to show you is that these data indicate a lot of inhomogeneity. The other thing that they indicate is that at low temperatures, these inhomogeneous spin fluctuations are becoming very, very slow. I'm going to address this very important phenomenon that Hakshimai has brought to everybody's attention, the copper wipeout phenomenon, and I will discuss it in the context of these slow spin fluctuations. The main point that I'm going to try and leave you with is that this inhomogeneity is a really very dominant property of these systems, and the further statement that I'm going to make is that it does not seem to be something that's determined by extrinsic disorder. I will show that we do a lot of different ways of creating extrinsic disorder, and we always seem to get the same answer. And so I'm going to propose that there's something more intrinsic about what we've seen, about this inhomogeneity. And the last bullet here will refer to the role of the lattice, but I think that what this will argue is something that I think most of us believe, and that is that although what we see in NMR has to do with spin, I think the charge dynamics have much to do with determining the spin dynamics that we're observing. And again, this is a point that has been made by many people. So I think we all know that phase separation is a very important issue in the context of an antiferromagnet doped with holes. There's reasons to expect phase separation just on the basis of magnetic interactions, where a hole destroys antiferromagnetic bonds, so you do better by putting two close together and reducing the number of bonds you destroy. There's also kinetic energy reasons that favor hole clustering of some sort, and that is because a moving hole leaves behind a string of misoriented spins. Now, you can fix this by doing various complicated paths to heal this string, but nonetheless, this amounts to an impediment to motion, and so the kinetic energy is also favored by clustering of the spins rather than trying to move a hole through an antiferromagnetic background. Now, for reasons that I think we heard discussed pretty extensively this morning and other times, it seems very likely that what's going to happen is it's not going to just make some big blob of holes. That's not a very nice way to solve this problem. But rather, it's going to make linear things, which are referred to as stripes. There's one very important aspect about these stripes that has emerged from both the data and from the thinking about the situation, and that is that they form antiphase domain walls. So they're not, there's something very special about this linear stripe. And so what that means is that if there were no hole here, you would expect that this spin would be down, this one would be up. So what you see in this picture is that there's been a 180-degree phase shift across this domain wall. And one reason that seems to be a sensible thing to do is because if the stripe moves laterally, it leaves behind properly ordered antiferromagnetic backgrounds. That makes it much easier to move, and that's a situation that the system prefers. But there's another important consequence of this, and that is that that means that domain wall motion couples directly to spin dynamics. So what you can see is that as this domain wall, if we imagine this domain wall moving across this row of spins, by the time it gets to the other side, it has flipped the orientation of those spins. So domain wall motion is directly going to lead to spin dynamics. And that's, I think, an important thing to keep in mind when looking at the data I'll be showing about spin dynamics, or in general, thinking about spin dynamics. Now, as we heard this morning, in this particular system, this rare earth co-doped system, in this case co-doped with neodymium, we have neutron diffraction evidence for precisely this phenomenon. And this is a picture from John Tranquata's paper showing the phenomenon I just indicated schematically on the previous slide. That is, charges ordered into linear stripes. The density of holes in these stripes is one hole per two copper sites. The neutron diffraction evidence is shown here, a splitting into incommensurate magnetic peaks around the magnetic Bragg peak, and a splitting of the lattice Bragg peaks into four satellites, or the appearance of four super lattice peaks around the Bragg peak, rather. And the importance of this antiphase relationship that I discussed previously is that the wavelength for the spin modulation, because of this antiphase relationship, is now twice the wavelength for the charge modulation, and that's directly reflected in the fact that the splitting of these incommensurate peaks is twice that of the magnetic peaks. So this picture seems to be working out pretty well. The other point that John makes, and I think that makes a lot of sense, is that the appearance of the charged superlattice peaks, which are shown here in the open symbols. Steve showed some more recent data that looks a little bit nicer this morning. I should get that and put it in. But it's the same general phenomenon, that this charged superlattice peak appears immediately below in temperature the onset of this structural phase transition. And the importance of this structural phase transition from the so-called low-temperature orthorhombic to low-temperature tetragonal is that it causes the corrugation of the copper oxide planes to have an orientation which is along the copper oxygen bonds, which in turn is thought to lead to pinning of these stripes, which want to orient in that same direction. It enables pinning to the lattice and allows you to see some these kinds of features in a static experiment. This is elastic neutron scattering, and so that's why you can see this elastic charged superlattice peak, because you've got pinning to the lattice. At least that's the picture. Then at lower temperatures, the onset of spin order is observed. So first these become apparent, and then the spin superlattice peaks appear. So one issue here is that when one would like to understand the dynamics associated with this situation, because we believe that this pinning is such an important issue, can we get some information about this pinning?
Do you have quantitative information on the new Bragg peak, its intensity in relation to the other Bragg peaks, other main Bragg peaks?
The lattice peaks,
yeah,
or the magnetic?
The magnitude of the distortion would be proportional to the intensity in the new Bragg peak.
Yes.
Do they have some quantitative information on whether it is 10 to the minus 2 of a lattice constant change, or 10 to the minus 4, or?
I don't know about the structural distortion. Do you know the answer to that? Well, I think they're very hard to quantify the amplitude of the charge modulation.
They're weak peaks, but I don't know if they know what the magnitude of the
peaks are. They haven't put counts per minute and compared to counts per minute.
They're on the first in the back.
It's extremely
low. But also X-ray measurements, when you see these, so they should be able to do that. I agree with you, but
okay, so I'm going to be talking about NMR experiments. I think most people are familiar with this, but I'll just quickly go through the kinds of things that we can do with a nuclear magnetic spin probe. The basic phenomenon that we exploit is the fact that the splitting between two nuclear spin states is determined by the total field that nuclear spin experiences via some hyperfine coupling. That local field is, at least in part, reflects the local spin orientation. So one can, for instance, do spectroscopy in which you measure the magnitude of this local static field, and that's reflected in a the splitting between the nuclear spin states. The way one does this experiment is one applies a radio frequency field at this particular frequency, which is resonant at the field that applies, and that induces transitions, and you detect that. This is how you do spectroscopy. You measure omega as a function of field, and you learn something about local fields. This is, of course, very important in the whole range of NMR industry, from biological through studies of electronic systems. The second thing, and the aspect that I'm going to focus on in my talk primarily, has to do with using NMR to measure spin dynamics. And the reason we can do that is because, as I mentioned, this transition occurs as a consequence of a field fluctuating at the Larmor frequency. So what one can do is one can take this system, drive it out of thermal equilibrium, and measure how long it takes to recover to thermal equilibrium, get the correct thermal equilibrium populations of these two spin states. And because those that thermal equilibrium recovery requires transitions between these spin states, that relaxation rate is a measure of the intensity of fluctuations at that Larmor frequency. So the formal expression is shown here, that it's, you take the spin autocorrelation function, you Fourier transform it, and look at the component at the Larmor frequency, the NMR frequency. So come up with this fairly straightforward expression, that the nuclear spin relaxation rate is proportional to the spectral density of electron spin fluctuations evaluated at the Larmor frequency. And then you note that there's this coefficient that tells you the ratio of these two rates, which is the square, proportional to the square of this hyperfine field that is experienced. So the first thing I'm going to do is show some spectroscopic experiments that we've done. And this is in a slightly different system. This is lanthanum strontium nickelate. It's isostructural to lanthanum cuprate. The thing that's attractive about this system is that it shows these stripes very robustly. One sees diffraction evidence very clearly for this stripe ordering in these nickelate materials. So it seems like a good place to start looking. This is work that we did with Song Chang. This shows diffraction data that they've done, that they took on this system, and they observed charge ordering to occur at about 240 Kelvin and then below this spin ordering. So this looks very similar to what I showed you for the cuprate from John Franquata's experiment. We took this same sample and we measured the static internal field that you should expect to see once there's spin ordering. And indeed, we see the growth of an internal field. It seems to, everything seems to be behaving very nice. First point I should make is that at charge ordering, one sees now in the lanthanum NMR spectrum the clear appearance of two peaks. And this is something you expect to see. If there are two environments, one in the stripe and one in the antiferromagnetically ordered region between the stripes, you expect to see two peaks. And
what's the spin of lanthanum-139?
Oh, it's very high. It's 7 halves.
And
so there's a lot of quadrupole stuff and all of that.
So you're looking at what transition?
This is the central transition, minus one half to one half. So this is appealing. We clearly see these two sites that you expect to see, and this gives you some confidence that you understand what's going on. One of the interesting things, though, is that we measure this internal field, and we see that it goes away at 160 Kelvin, whereas the neutron people saw this spin superlattice peak appearing at 190 Kelvin. So this is one of the sort of hallmark signatures of a glassy situation, where the frequency of the probe determines the ordering temperature. And so even in this system where we believe that the stripes are well-defined and easy to see, we're seeing this glassy behavior. Another thing that perhaps is not expected is also hinted here in these series of spectra. You see that at low temperatures, we start seeing very broad lines.
Chris, am I not right that here also in the diffraction, the peaks are not resolution limited?
That's correct. In fact, one of the central themes of this paper was this liquid crystal kind of ordering.
Between the charge ordering.
Right. It's this complicated, you know.
No, but I mean, even at low temperature, the peaks are finite width.
That's right.
So at high temperatures above this ordering transmissions. I guess what I'm going to ask is, are all the Lansman sites equivalent to each other?
No. We see two distinguished peaks.
No, I mean above the ordering temperature.
Oh, yes. Very sharp, nice line above the ordering.
Are they crystallographically equivalent? I mean, is there only a single point?
Yes.
So it's this 5/3 is some kind of structure in which everything sits in the same environment?
Okay, well, no, there's disorder due to the doping. This is random. This is a randomly located doping. But it has a very weak effect on this line width.
There's no sort of emotional averaging
that
makes it narrow.
We tried to make that work, and that doesn't seem to be a very good explanation. In other words, is this a spin? Are these fluctuating stripes up here, and that's why we don't see it? Is that the question?
Above here. The width of the line at 300K. That's really. I mean, I don't know the system very well. I'm just trying to understand.
That's a pretty sharp line on our scale.
Sharp because of what?
We believe it's not due to motional narrowing of these two different sites, but that's not something that we can say absolutely. We tried to work out that scenario. Are the stripes existing at higher temperatures and just being motionally averaged out? And that didn't seem to explain things very well. Plus, we see the same ordering temperature as the neutrons, which suggests that that's not the right explanation. Because if it were just if you had dynamics at all temperatures, then you would expect to see something different at a picosecond scale probe than you do in a microsecond scale probe.
You can probably tell whether this is a... It's probably not an exchange shift, but some kind of dipolar shift. Because there are not too many electrons there. The Lansman nickel side is literally the magnetic side here, and that's in the plane, and Lansman's are presumably in between the planes.
Okay.
Is this dipolar? Can you tell from
No, it's a transferred hyperfine coupling. It's about an order of magnitude too big for a direct dipolar coupling.
But it's reasonable for a hyperfine.
Yes, and it's because in the nickelate, the 3z squared orbital is also partially occupied, so there's a much stronger overlap with the lanthanum. So this is a factor of 10 larger than the hyperfine coupling in the cuprate. That's exactly right, and it's so simpler for that reason. Okay, so I just want to show some spectra that we obtained in this material. And by the way, this nickelate work was all done by Yosuke Yoshinari. And the point here is that at low temperatures, there's this remarkably broad spectrum. And the width of this spectrum is approximately twice this hyperfine field that we were just discussing. If you had a nice antiferromagnet, you expect to see two peaks. And instead, we see this very, very broad smear, which is indicative, the first order of all orientations of spins in the plane. We're working with H in the planes. All orientations of the spins in the plane. However, one thing that's peculiar, and the first point is related to Steve's point, is that, as he says, there's evidence in the neutron scattering that the charge order is not truly long-range ordered, and if you think about it a little bit, you realize that with these antiphase domain walls, that when you introduce disorder into the stripes, you can create a lot of difficulties for the spins, because it doesn't know how to resolve this antiphase relationship when a stripe ends or when there's a bifurcation.
We could just help me to recollect it. I've somewhat expected this when you have oxygen doped nickel oxide and you're sitting at an optional state, which is the same doping as strontium. That oxygen is nicely ordering, right? And that whole thing should be much more strongly ordered than the strontium dope. I've somewhat expected this that things look actually quite similar if you go to strontium or oxygen. Is that a right recollection?
You should know better than I, right? Yeah. You were the author on that paper. I don't know if this is entirely fair or not. I cannot exactly remember.
You won't be great. Attention to this. So. As if it sounded that he say, what is this order
I cannot remember the line shapes in Hans's paper. I
remember that it looked very similar to what you had.
Yeah, there were some differences, but I don't remember the line width. I think it's pretty clear that this is not something that has to do with strontium, the disorder due to strontium. One thing that's very peculiar about this is, although this is very broad and indicative of a wide range of orientations, it is not indicative of a random or uniform orientation of spins in the plane. Because for that, you expect this classic powder pattern kind of thing, because the spin, the orientations where H is nearly parallel with the applied field has a much higher density of states with almost the same shift, because you can rotate this thing through a wide range of angles here, and they all give essentially the same shift, whereas when it's perpendicular, you get this much lower density of states. That's very clearly not what we see. And so in fact, what we conclude is that the spins prefer to orient perpendicular to the applied field, but with a very broad distribution about that. So these spins are soft, they rotate with the field, but they don't, there's not some nice anti-ferromagnetic order that rotates with the field, but this very, very strong disorder. So I don't kind of understand this, but the point is that even this well-ordered, in principle, well-ordered thing has what I would say is pervasive spin disorder. So these stripe-ordered systems are, I think, inclined toward strong disorder.
Is there an ESR experiment on this?
A MuSR experiment?
Yeah, that was crazy.
I don't remember. I cannot think of such an experiment. I would imagine they would, but I'm not aware of that. Okay, so the first thing is, do we see such structure in the cuprates? And it's something that you would like to see. We see no such thing in the copper line, other than the relatively well-known AB site that came up this morning in the discussion. We see essentially the same line shape as we cool down. Not even any change in width. This seems to be unchanged. Now, this might not be such a good way to go about it, because these lines are reasonably broad. So what about lanthanum? And if you look at lanthanum, in fact, there is some peculiar stuff going on. And this is a point that also has come up in Marc-Henri Julien's data. We see this peculiar structure developing in the lanthanum line shape. And to compress the talk a little bit, which maybe I've overcompressed, but this is essentially a plot of intensity versus field.
This is a particularly unfortunate thing to do, right? Putting europium in there?
You might say that. You mean because of disordering?
No, because of europium has got magnetic moments.
No, that's exactly why we chose europium. It's the only one that does not.
It's europium.
J equals zero. That's exactly why we use that rather than...
The field is J equals zero, certainly not. Europium 3 plus is not.
Yes. At low temperature, it's J equals zero. That's why we don't use neodymium. That's exactly the point. Thank you for making that point, actually. it's small, so at high temperatures, you start to excite higher J. But
you're saying europium 3 plus is F zero?
Is J equals zero, yes.
It has an F electron. It has some F electrons, europium.
Yes, but the
it's a crystal field says J equals zero.
No, just because of LS coupling.
So you're saying it's L equal to 3, S equal to 3.
Yes.
It's got six F electrons. Okay. Fine. It can L minus S is zero, and J is L minus S by zero.
Okay. I was getting worried.
No,
I'm the one that is. Okay. So you see a lot of structure in these spectra. The point of this slide is to say that all of this structure can be understood as reflecting distributions of distributions of tilt of the electric field gradient, which we attribute in turn to distributions of tilt of the octahedra. In other words, there's no reason to attribute this to different charge. Charge occupation on different sites. So this can all be, now, of course, octahedral tilt is related to charge on the copper sites, so this might be an indirect indication of something like this. But the other point is that it's very inhomogeneous. One point that's rather peculiar about this, in fact, is that we can look at a very heavily doped sample. This is europium with a lot of strontium, and look at the tilt as a function of temperature, and we find that, in fact, the high temperature tetragonal phase in which these tilts should vanish, the octahedra are supposed to be rigorously parallel to the C-axis, and in fact, that's what's observed in crystallographic measurements. This tilt, first of all, does not even notice the existence of that phase transition, and secondly, we see finite tilts at above that transition temperature. So again, there's disorder in the tilt that's fairly pervasive and seems to be really not very mindful of the global structural phase that we're inhabiting. So the conclusion here is that we're not seeing the two sites that we would like to see that would reflect two sites as determined by the charge. We are seeing structure that may be indicative of something that's due to charge, but we're not able to interpret that directly in that light. All right, so I think for the remainder of the talk, I'm going to be discussing spin dynamics. I will first discuss lanthanum nuclear spin lattice relaxation. This is a good probe because the reasons that came up having to do with hyperfine coupling. It's out of the plane. It's weakly coupled to these slow spin fluctuations. So you can measure it at all temperatures, and you can make some sense of the spin dynamics because it does not the signal does not disappear. The very clear conclusion that one comes to is that one finds an inhomogeneous distribution of spin fluctuation frequencies, electron spin fluctuations, that is. And as I made earlier, the point that I will try to emphasize primarily is this seemingly ubiquitous and intrinsic inhomogeneity. I will then turn to the topic of copper wipeout. I know you've heard from Takashi a couple days earlier, so I will give the point of view that we have on this issue. I think that we believe that it's not clear that it's a direct measure of the strike order parameter. On the other hand, for a host of reasons, I think it's very reasonable to conclude that it's reflecting some aspect of charge dynamics. And this is the hard link to make. How do you conclude something about the charge dynamics, or what can you say about the charge dynamics having this very sensitive measure of the spin dynamics available?
Just before you continue, I'm a bit confused. The Takashi showed us these NMR signals, NMR, right? Light shapes, which are sort of asymmetric at very low temperatures.
Right. This is.
And how does
copper.
How is copper.
Right. And that's very, very, that's 3/10 of a Kelvin.
You have to go to very low temperature to see any significant change in light shape.
Yeah, and he's looking for this static moment that the muons apparently claim to see, and this is a very important thing to sort out.
Yeah.
Very important and hard, I think. It's also worth saying. All right, so the first thing that one should mention is that at the outset we have evidence from muons that there's a glassy character to this spin ordering that has been seen in the neutron scattering. This was pointed out by the Chumate et al. Based on muon spin resonance. And they did the experiment, which is exactly analogous to the experiment I showed in the nickelate, except they used muons to measure the magnitude of the internal field due to the spin ordering of the moments in the regions between the charge-ordered stripes, between the stripes. And what they pointed out was that whereas in neutrons one saw a onset of spin ordering at 50 Kelvin, with the much slower probe of muons, one sees a lower temperature onset. And from that they pointed out that this is again a fairly clear indication of glassy dynamics. At the same
time, has no superconductivity.
That's correct. No superconductivity. Okay. I guess at 1/8, even John agrees with this, right?
I think they think that from neodymium 0.4, there. I mean, on his phase diagram, he has something like 6 Kelvin superconductivity. So.
Okay. I would say that there's still dispute. I think that's a safe statement about whether there's superconductivity. It's a tricky issue. But to first order, it's at least a very strongly suppressed TC.
Is there some systematic correlation between the intensity of stripes seen and TC in a given compound?
Intensity?
Well, you change the amount of neodymium ratio and you change stripe intensity.
When you go to neodymium 6, mm-hmm. nobody says there's superconductivity.
And
the strike order is much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, and that's so what you're doing is changing the character of the octahedral tilt by changing the neodymium.
So phenomenologically, more stripes, less TC.
Yeah.
at least more static stripes, I think. All right, so fairly early in the game, Van Bruckner's collaborators were doing electron spin resonance measurements, which really can be taken to be entirely analogous to lanthanum spin lattice relaxation measurements that, that I have been discussing and will be discussing. What they saw was a dramatic increase in the electron spin, and here they're using a gadolinium probe, and they're measuring T1 there. They see a dramatic increase in the 1 over T1, which is indicative of a compression of all the spin fluctuations to this low frequency, and so one can extract the characteristic spin fluctuation frequency. I will talk about this in more detail in a moment. And so they were concluding this quite dramatic freezing of spin fluctuations at low temperature. This was, in fact, reminiscent then, and it's one of the things that motivated a lot of our work in this area, of some very important work that was done quite early in the game, 93, by the Ames Lab Group, Fernando Borsa, David Johnston, and co-workers, Feng Cheng Chu. And what they showed was that at very low temperatures, there was this dramatic peak in the lanthanum spin lattice relaxation rate. So again, this is this very analogous to what we just saw. What's happening here is all this spectral density is being compressed into the frequency regime around the lanthanum alarm or frequency. They interpreted this, or they speculated or suggested that this had something to do with pinning of charge carriers in these materials.
This is in the insulator.
That's right. This is an anti-ferromagnetic insulator. So this is below, so this, for instance, is the nail temperature, which is an interesting point. The nail temperature is a fairly minor event on this in this relaxation rate compared to this very dramatic peak deep in the anti-ferromagnetic phase.
And it doesn't look like that with x equal to zero?
No. Well,
this is all due to strontium, and then it's
yes.
more or less independent of concentration.
That's I'm going to discuss that in some detail. But they showed a phase diagram. It's a fairly famous phase diagram at this point, where this what they plotted was the magnitude of this freezing temperature as a function of doping, and that freezing temperature changes with doping, goes up and then decreases, and essentially becomes this spin glass freezing temperature that we saw. I'll show some of these phase diagrams later, but. The doping, the basic point that I'm going to make is that this you see this very same behavior all the way up to very heavily doped materials. If you put in the rare earth, you see essentially the same behavior, and I'll talk more about that. Now, the first thing that we thought about doing to see if this had something to do with pinning of charge carriers was to dramatically alter the character of the disorder. And that is, instead of doping with strontium, which is out of plane, dope with lithium, which substitutes for copper, which should have a huge effect on in-plane scattering. And quite surprisingly to us, we saw essentially the same behavior. For us, the important breakthrough was obtaining extremely nice single crystals of this europium co-doped material. Again, europium being selected because it does not have the magnetic moment. Single crystals allowing us to do nuclear magnetic resonance rather than having to do zero field measurements. And here we have essentially one-eighth doped crystal, where we again see this very same, very strong peak. And so it was this strong peak that, at this point, led us to really try and understand this in some detail. And it turns out one can do that. And in fact, we believe that this is something that's exactly analogous to phenomena that were first pointed out by Bombergen, Purcell, and Pound very early in the development of the NMR technique. So it's in fact known as the BPP peak. And the way that works is shown here. Now, as I mentioned earlier in the talk, the relaxation rate is a measure of the spectral density of spin fluctuations at the Larmor frequency. It's the, that, in turn, is the Fourier transform of the spin autocorrelation function, which is typically exponentially decaying, so that you get a Lorentzian dependence of the spectral density on frequency, and it's characterized by this correlation time, which you might expect in an electronic system to be something like J, but in fact, in the experiments they did, they were working in liquids. It was determined by tumbling of molecules. And so what happens is you get, if you plot J on a log-log plot, you get something which is flat out to a characteristic time a frequency of 1 over tau c, and then it rolls over with an omega squared tail. The area under this curve must be conserved. It's just the because it originates from the spin autocorrelation function. So that means that as 1 over tau decreases, pushing this knee down, the low frequency weight must increase. So what happens is as temperature decreases, if 1 over tau is going down, you're pushing up this low frequency spectral weight, and this leads to an enhancement of relaxation rate. Here, this is a plot again of Lanthanum relaxation rate versus 1 over t to show this very nicely, shows this activated behavior, which again was exactly what was observed in this earlier experiment. So what happens is as you decrease temperature, relaxation rate is increasing strongly because you're compressing all of the spectral wave into the region of the Larmor frequency. But then if you push that too far and move 1 over tau c below the Larmor frequency, you find yourself on this 1 over omega squared tail, and the spectral density starts to decrease. Now there's a very nice thing about this, and that is that when you're in the regime when 1 over tau is larger than omega, you should see frequency-independent behavior. Once you pass through that peak, you should see frequency-dependent behavior, because then you're on this 1 over omega squared tail. As you can see, this is precisely what we find. By doing experiments at different frequency, we see frequency-independent behavior. On the high-temperature side, you go through the peak, and you see precisely the frequency dependence, which is predicted by this Lorentzian behavior. So this is satisfying for the fact that it seems to be rather simply understandable in terms of this well-known behavior. The one difference between the behavior that was shown here and our situation is that it is not possible to understand this in terms of a single well-defined activation energy. The most simple manifestation is that this should drop very rapidly once you've passed through a temperature such that KT is less than this activation energy. It should fall off very steeply. In fact, we find that the tail is very broad. What that tells you is that there are some regions of the sample that have very small activation energies. So you have to conclude some kind of a distribution. We chose something that was easy for us to deal with. We don't claim something to understand in detail this distribution, but what's very clear is you have to have a distribution of activation energies.
Chris, yes? can you tell the difference between that, or suppose it was non-exponential decay, but homogeneous? So you've made an inhomogeneous model.
You're talking about the recovery of the magnetization, the time dependent.
Yeah, so here you've assumed that the time dependence is exponential.
He hasn't said what T1 is. I mean, presumably the recovery you see is because you have this multi-level spin system, you have some complicated recovery that you fit to a model. And you extract.
Well, it's very well known exactly what it's a multi-comp, but it does make it difficult to extract multiple T1s. But let me think. You're saying, do we have to have no? In fact,
so, I mean, suppose you this was a homogeneous signal, but with
No. It's simply the fact that relaxation rate stays very large down to very low temperatures. You've got to have very low, whatever. Okay, you can change the shape of this. You've got to have some regions where 1 over tau is still much larger.
Steve's point is correct, that you get VPP only for inhomogeneous disordered light. You can only narrow.
Oh, no, no.
You cannot.
No, no.
This is a form of motional narrowing, which you cannot narrow homogeneous light.
No. I don't think I understand what you're saying. This has nothing to do with motional narrowing.
It is motion narrowing in the sense that your relaxation rate tau sub c in one case and 1 over tau sub c in the other case. It's precisely
motion. Well, okay, I'm not sure. Maybe there's not some importance in that name.
Sure.
But the point is, the crucial issue is the Larmor frequency large or small compared to 1 over tau? That's true. The detailed nature, the detailed shape of this curve is very unimportant. This kind of behavior is simply a reflection of 1 over tau of 1 over tau passing through omega. I mean, okay, it can't be something that does something completely pathological like increases at high omega or something. All it has to do is have some shape that decreases with a characteristic frequency scale determined by 1 over tau. That's the point.
I guess it's got a distribution. I mean, you really get information at low temperatures, right? About the distribution.
That's right.
You go to
well, you have to be.
Uh, below it almost, the picture, then you...
Okay. There's some effect on this leading edge, but that's primarily right. The most obvious effect is these very low temperatures.
So it could still be that the distribution with this change is for temperature.
Yes, absolutely. We cannot, it's very hard to say anything in detail about this distribution other than that it's not a single well-defined activation energy. That's correct. But okay, on the other hand, it's the characteristic scale is 50, 60, 70 Kelvin, which I think is an interesting, I mean, it's a very small number. Okay, and another point that's nice about this is that now we can characterize this in terms of some physical parameter. Obviously, the temperature at which the peak occurs is a frequency-dependent number. This is not a universal number. On the other hand, this activation energy is something that should describe all experiments, which is attractive. Okay, so now we go back and we look at a range of data in this light, that is trying to extract activation energies and widths. And so here's a series of compounds that have been looked at. The first one is this data from Ames Lab. The other three are our data. This is lanthanum strontium cuprate, very lightly doped, out of plane. This is the lithium dope, so the same doping, but what one would expect would be something that would have very different, for instance, if you're thinking of pinning of stripes, you would think that lithium in plane and strontium out of plane would be very different. Not at all what is observed, you know, differences of less than a factor of two in these pinning energies. Then we go to this system which has europium, and as I mentioned earlier, the idea there is that the LTT structure should pin stripes. Again, we see very, very similar behavior. So this is, I think, a very striking feature. And note here that we're looking at a range of doping which is a factor of 10 different from very light doping, 1.5% up to 1/8. And we've got data up to 0.2, as I was showing earlier. And you see essentially very similar behavior. Actually, 0.2 behaves somewhat differently, but up to 0.15.
So this, as you referred to, famous phase diagram of Johnson, that phase transition,
right.
And you say, is it the phase transition?
That's right. I definitely think that's not a phase transition. That's right. It has something to do with some glassy kind of, and some characteristic energy is causing that behavior. That's right.
Is there any experiment between 1.5 and 7%?
Between these two. Marc-Henri Julien has has a CONMAT out at without the europium, and the data are extremely remarkably similar for 0.1. That's a superconductor. We are working in that regime with the europium right now, but I don't have data for that right now. But the data from Marc-Henri looks remarkably similar. Okay, so this is really sort of the punchline that I really want to emphasize. This is not something which looks to me like it's determined by the extrinsic disorder. It looks to me like it has something to do with doped copper oxide planes. And I think that's a very important point that needs to be kept in mind when looking at these systems. It seems to be a very intrinsically disordered system. All right, now what I'd like to do now is give our point of view on the issue of copper wipeout. And then I think our point's actually a fairly simple one and perhaps has been misunderstood, so I hope I can state it pretty clearly. What I'm going to show is that the copper wipeout can be directly understood as arising from these very slow spin fluctuations. So copper wipeout is directly attributable to spin effects. And therefore, it is not necessary just on the basis of that measurement to conclude that it has something to do with charges ordering into stripes. What I believe, and I think most people believe, is that charge dynamics have something to do with determining the spin fluctuation frequency. And therefore, an indirect relationship between stripe formation and wipeout is certainly possible and is, in fact, likely. But the only point that I want to make is that one cannot directly conclude from copper wipeout that you're seeing charge stripe order. You have to look at all of the evidence, all of the collection of measurements, and decide for yourself if you think that that's the origin of these slow spin fluctuations. What I'm going to show you is that we, given the data I've just taken in lanthanum, which as I said is nice because it's a weakly coupled spectator nucleus, you can directly take that characterization of the spin fluctuations, plug it in, and predict copper wipeout. Now, Pakshiyamaya has done a very hard and important job in bringing this to the attention of the community, showing that, giving us an idea of its generality and of the phase diagram, and I think it's very enriching of this result to understand exactly what underlies that copper wipeout phenomenon that he's shown us. All right, so what's the basic story here? It's quite simple, in fact. As I mentioned, 1 over T1 is proportional to this hyperfine field squared. And as I mentioned, lanthanum is nice because it's very weakly coupled. It has a very small coupling constant to those spins because it's far out of the planes. The copper is very, very strongly, the copper nucleus is very, very strongly coupled because they're on the same atom. And so you have a hyperfine field which differs by 2 orders of magnitude. So when you square that, you have a relaxation rate which would differ by 4 orders of magnitude. Now what I'm showing over here are plots of the copper relaxation rate as a function of temperature and the lanthanum relaxation rate. And what you should notice is that this is the structural phase transition that's very clearly evident in the lanthanum. What you should notice is that the behavior bear essentially no resemblance. And if you look closely at this, you can see why. The relaxation rate is extremely high at this peak. Relaxation time is less than a millisecond, of order half a millisecond at that peak. If you divide that by 10 to the fourth, you're getting times in the nanosecond regime, which is simply not possible to measure with an NMR spectrometer. So what's happening is there's some point here where the relaxation rate becomes so fast that the signal is completely relaxed before your spectrometer can ever recover from the excitation pulses that you used to excite the signal. Now, if this were a homogeneous situation, you then would expect that at some temperature determined by the T1 that's set by your spectrometer, the signal should just blink out. It should go from 1 to 0. But as Takashi has shown us, that's not what happens. It comes down gradually with temperature, and that's a direct demonstration of the same inhomogeneity. But the basic point here is that relaxation rates this strong with such a strong coupling are simply not observable in an NMR spectrometer. All right, so can we do this in a little bit more detail? We have measured distributions of activation energies using lanthanum relaxation. And one point that's important that I've emphasized is that the lanthanum signal is observable at all temperatures. So that means you're looking at the entire sample, so the relaxation rate you measure has some meaning in that sense. Now, from this distribution of activation energies, you directly get a distribution of tau. So as a function of temperature, that distribution in tau is changing as the temperature essentially scans through this peak in activation energies. At very high temperatures, most of the spin fluctuations are still very fast because you're above all of the activation energy, so this is peaked at low frequencies. Now the point is, as I mentioned, there's some characteristic time scale set by your spectrometer. How fast can it recover? At high temperatures, the characteristic tau's primarily fall below that, so you see the entire signal. But as you go down in temperature, you get more and more very, very slow spin fluctuations. And as I was showing, slow spin fluctuations lead to very, very rapid relaxation. So it's a very straightforward exercise to convert this into this distribution of tau's, and then you integrate from this, from zero up to the cutoff determined by your spectrometer, and you can predict the copper wipeout. So this is, I think, a reasonably straightforward way of understanding this phenomenon, and it relies only on the existence of slow inhomogeneous spin fluctuations. Now, a very nice result aspect of this is that this is now explicit and completely model-free demonstration of inhomogeneity. NMR is a local probe, so if you see that half of the spins are visible, the other half are invisible, that directly tells you that half of the spins are in a different environment. In particular, they're in an environment with very slow spin fluctuations, which wipe out the signal. So very direct demonstration of inhomogeneity.
Just ask it. I guess I don't understand this at all. Normally, I would think that if you have fast spin relaxation, 1 over T1, that it's easy to see the NMR.
No, but
because
But what, okay, so you produce a, you rotate magnetization down into the plane,
right?
And then if it rotates, if it relaxes in 1 nanosecond, we're trying to detect that signal. But the way we excite that signal is we put in a 1 kilovolt pulse into our low noise ultra sensitive preamp. It takes it a few microseconds to get over that insult and come back to the business of measuring a signal. So by that time it's already relaxed and there's no magnetization processing in the transverse plane to detect with your coil.
Okay, so T1 and T2 equal T1.
Okay, 1/2, yes.
Both, yeah,
in the limit.
It's a very broad line, right?
That's true. But,
so
the physical phenomenon is what I just described. The spin magnetization simply does not last long enough for your spectrometer to recover from. It's a technical issue. It has to do with how fast a recovery your preamp can drain off this charge on its input that you put on it with this large excitation pulse.
Okay, but it's basically a broad line, so maybe that's not the best
it's
way to look
a, it's
at it.
It's a homogeneously broad line. That's completely correct. I'm not sure that for everybody, maybe doesn't convey the reason you don't see the signal. But it is true. It's you have very, very fast relaxation. It's a very short lifetime, therefore a very broad line.
Question, Chris. I guess by looking at the white out, you get more direct information on the distribution of activation energy also. Is it sort of temperature independent? Do you have to say that? Is it really sort of temperature independent distribution?
The trouble is that the coupling of copper to these spin fluctuations is so strong that as soon as you enter the get even close to the activation energy, it completely takes that out of the signal.
Okay.
We haven't tried to do that in detail. That might be right. Another difficulty is that it's very hard to measure intensity with high precision. It's a very difficult experiment because all sorts of characteristics of your spectrometer are changing with decreasing temperature. So it's a very hard measurement. But it is a different point of view it's a different way of looking at it. I mean, maybe by taking two sets of data, you might be able to do a better job.
Let's say we would make this PEA very, very temperature dependent. Would you still get this characteristic? Why aren't you behavior sensitive, are you?
I'm worried my travel flows.
Yeah, it's all integrals, which is a problem. I think I would say that one cannot distinguish a temperature-dependent distribution from just scanning through this distribution, but we haven't tried to do that. I really think that's one should not overemphasize the use of this as a diagnostics. My point here is to say that we can fundamentally understand wipeout is arising from slow spin fluctuations. I think that's really the point that we're trying to make.
I'm asking this all the time because I would have an intuition to cut me out at high temperature. There's a fair amount of annealing due to these thermal fluctuations, and I would expect distributions to be more narrow. And then you got low temperatures, I would expect the distribution to widen. I'm just wondering how far it's different from the data.
I think there's confusion here. So he's parameterizing with distribution sigma, so he has Gaussian temperature dependent distribution.
Yeah, okay.
So the distribution itself is
broadening
with decreasing temperature.
Okay.
The distribution
right.
of relaxation
rates,
not
the temperature.
Parameter
right.
is just one fixed parameter.
Yeah, no, but what Milan is saying is that he thought the distribution of energy of activation
well, this
would
change
itself
the temperature.
Should be temperature.
Oh,
this is this we could not we, it would have to be a very dramatic kind of binary thing for us to see that, I think.
Is this spin freezing a sharp phenomenon as a function of temperature?
I don't think so, but maybe. I mean, what's happening is temperature just scanning through this distribution. So as you have sites, I mean, the first order sites with EA greater than T rapidly become invisible in the copper signal. So you just think of temperature scanning through this. But I mean,
because
I cannot tell you for sure that this is temperature independent, is Jan's point.
Because for low doping, as you pointed out, there was a phase diagram, a phase boundary, so for the spin class.
Yes.
Now that you have gone to higher doping, how does that phase boundary go?
Okay, I'm going to show some of these phase diagrams later in the talk, and maybe if you could, might be easier to talk about that if we're looking at that plot. Okay, so again, I'm going to repeat it just so minimize the chances of misunderstanding. All we're saying here is that copper wipeout is understandable in terms of slow spin fluctuations. And that's the piece of data that you can walk out of here, I plan, and be confident about. Much harder is to say, what's causing this? What's this due to? And I think that there's very good reason to think that that has something to do with charge dynamics. I argued at the beginning that charge dynamics certainly result in spin dynamics. But once you just know that you're making that step, it should not be something that you do unconsciously, because it's the whole question. What's the origin of that, in my view?
Can you estimate exactly then how fast, I mean, you know, 1 over T1 or 1 over T2, where the line width becomes in this?
Yes, we've done that. We have a paper, and we've done.
So what is it? I mean, like in megahertz or something like that. Presumably there's some 1 over T. What's the
1 over T1s of order 10 microseconds are
10 microseconds.
Yes.
So it corresponds to, so it's like a 100 kilohertz line width on that 80 megahertz or something like that.
Homogeneous line width.
Right.
I mean, we have huge inter-homogeneous broadenings, but yes.
Okay.
I mean, I showed you that the copper line is kilogauss wide. It's a couple of kilogauss wide.
Right, but you're saying that this intrinsic lifetime, or this due to these processes, is on the order of 100 kilohertz or something.
When it's lost.
Right. And then, do you think it gets much larger than that, or do you have?
Yes, I mean, let me think. Actually, what should happen is at very low temperature, it should recover. I think this is what Takashi is, I don't know if he talked about this, but he's been looking for a recovery at low temperatures because of the characteristics of that BPP plot. That when you slide back down that curve, eventually the signal should recover.
Okay.
So there's the peak occurs at, and I don't.
Okay, so you're saying, so you've got this intrinsically broad line on top, but it's also inhomogeneously broad much more, so you just don't have any way of getting at it with pulsed NMR or
getting at the, I mean, you can measure
the,
where you can see the signal, you can measure 1 over T1, 1 over T2, and we've done that as well.
If you're above the wipeout temperature, can you do hole burning to look for this inhomogeneity? That might be able to get it.
I think what you're asking about is exactly what Charlie and Jürgen Haas have been trying, and that they've done a little bit more sophisticated double resonance experiments, and it doesn't work. Every spin is coupled to everything in the entire spectrum. And from that, they conclude that these modulations have to be on length scales, very short length scales. In other words, every copper spin sees something with very different, it occurs in a very different place in the line, so a very different local environment. Okay, you want to do a hole, if you can do a hole burning experiment, that means that they do a double resonance experiment, and if you were to flip all of the spins and see how that affected the coupled spins, if you saw that occurring in the very same narrow spot, you might say, well, the left half of the sample has all got this resonant frequency, and the right half has all got this resonance frequency. That's not what they observe. They do an NMR experiment where they flip something in a very narrow bandwidth, and they see that the entire spectrum is affected by that.
They're doing copper NMR?
They're doing copper and oxygen.
So what about what?
And oxygen.
But what about doing lanthanum NMR? So you have a distribution of relaxation rates. You presumably also have a distribution of frequencies as well.
Yes, and it's very quadruple brought in by this europium. It's very inhomogeneously broad. So what?
And there's no correlation between the inhomogeneous.
We haven't done that. Have you done that, Takashi? Measure T1 across the line? I think what he wants to know is measure T1 across the line.
Yeah.
The NQR line.
Copper actually I talked about.
But
might be able to get some information about the question Jan was asking about the temperature dependence of the distribution, because it's in the high temperature regime that you want that.
Oh, you're saying by spectral selection, you should be able to measure some little slice of this distribution. That's a good idea, and we're thinking about doing it in a slightly different experiment, but that's a good idea. That's a good idea. I'm not so sure. I mean, maybe I need to change my attitude here, but I haven't regarded this so much as a is something we're going to try and detail map out, because I'm not confident that we can do that very satisfactorily. Really, though, the point is that it exists is, I think, the point that is the most important one to take out. It's going to be very hard to really do that in a quantitative way, because you're always sort of, you're sensitive, you know, it's an integral, and so you're really not, it's a hard way to, it's not a spectroscopy that immediately can just pick out that activation energy. It's a very indirect. So we're going to try and do more specific experiments, but I'm not promising at all to produce some really detailed explanation of that distribution.
Your universality somehow suggests that the origin of this is a collective effect. It's not just due to dirt. And if it's a collective effect, it might have some interesting temperature dependence.
Okay, the temperature dependence is the key. That's
well,
true.
In classical distribution, your distribution should change. Obviously, it's broader as you go down.
Okay, so let's, I want to get to the phase diagrams that we were talking about earlier. One point to make is that this is actually something that's been seen previously. Charlie will be here next week, but this is some data from a fairly old paper of his in a classic spin glass system, and this wipeout is observed, including this little recovery at low temperature, which you expect as things actually order. So this is something that's not unknown. Now, one of the things I think is very exciting is that Takashi has shown that this is a very general phenomenon, and in particular, it occurs in the materials that we're most interested in, namely those that are superconducting, and he's shown that there's this very, this behavior is seen over a broad range of samples. And I think that that's a very useful result, and the only point that I've been trying to make is that one should, again, should understand is that this is directly understandable as a freezing transition. If one wants to argue that that's a charge ordering transition, that's fine, but that step should be made explicit. But I think that it's very important to note that this inhomogeneity, again, explicitly this demonstrates inhomogeneity, is not confined, for instance, to these rare earth doped systems, but is general to lanthanum cuprate, and we can be grateful for that information. Now then, this is a phase diagram which explicitly brings out freezing temperatures and glass temperatures. These are muon spin resonance measurements by Christos Panagopoulos. The way he does his measurements, I just want to, to briefly say is they measure the recovery. It's essentially the same measurement I'm talking about. They're measuring the recovery, or rather the decay of the muon spin polarization. This typically has a Gaussian behavior, beta equals 2. What they noted is that they start to get so-called stretched exponential recoveries. And this is directly interpretable in terms of inhomogeneity. So what they plot are two things.
Beta is 2? Beta is bigger than 1?
Yeah. It's 2 at high temperature.
Huh. That's unstretched.
What they do is they first note the temperature at which it drops below 2. They call that TF. And then they note the temperature at which it goes to 0.5. And apparently, the muon community, 0.5 is the definition of the glass temperature. Now, it looks to me like there's nothing particularly special about 0.5, but you can get these temperatures. The point, though, that I think is I want to emphasize is that there's a similarity here between the phase diagram that Takashi has given us and the phase diagram that's related to freezing from muon spin resonance. So again,
there's two temperatures there. One, when it goes to half, which you call spin glass temperature,
which you call
T. And then he has something else. Now, this other temperature here, thought that was also supposed to be the
this
spin
one?
Glass freezing. No, not in the other thing.
This one.
This, sorry. Panagopoulos.
Yes.
Identifies that as the glass.
T glass and T freezing. This
T glass
is
and T something
TF. TF and TG.
We don't know what TF is, but now my question was here, this temperature on the right hand side, this is supposed to be a spin glass temperature, or isn't it?
Basically, the upper curve is where things start.
Sorry?
The upper line is where things start.
Yeah.
Right. That's where you first start to observe inhomogeneous behavior. And copper is a little bit different because copper is very.
Anything different than the TG?
In NMR?
Well, so TG is
is defined at the time scale where muon the instance is basically floats and spins. So like -7 × −7 seconds. But the way they are defining this TF is basically deviation from dipole hypercomplexity. I mean, fluctuation of the magnetic hypercomplexity becomes noticeable. That's also a key question.
Okay. But another point is actually, in for them, this is not the point at which they see a frozen moment, but it's at the point at which they see this, this different time scale. And presumably, it should be related to the occurrence of a static field. But they've defined it that they've used 2 1/2 as the criteria for glass, for these glass temperatures.
Isn't it true that earlier in NMR and NQR did see some diverging time scales on TG, the phase boundary?
Okay, that's the so-called famous phase diagram that I mentioned earlier from the Ames lab group. That was the peak in that Lanthanum relaxation rate that I mentioned. And so that's, okay, so it seems to be certainly related phenomenon. I think this is definitely the same behavior, the same physical phenomena. It has to do with exactly how you extract it from the data. That freezing temperature.
Pulling into real freezing temperatures, which lead to ice, losing out, then there's slowing down going on, mules are a bit fast, you see that a bit higher temperature. And then the NMR is telling us that even at much lower temperatures, there's still a lot of motion out there, and it's not like a real diverging time scale.
Right.
As you would have in window glass or something.
I think that's right. Okay. So finally, I don't know. I'll do this very quickly. The difficulty with NMR is it's a local probe. You're not going to ever be able to tell somebody about the spatial ordering of, for instance, stripes. What you can do, though, is get some information about local correlations. What is the size scale over which some of these behavior are observed? The spin-spin relaxation rate is a measure of the coupling of one copper nucleus to a neighbor. And it has this Gaussian behavior. Takashi pointed out in his paper that there was this rather peculiar phenomenon that this behavior changes with decreasing temperature. It starts at high temperature looking Gaussian, which is what one expects, but at low temperatures it evolves into this exponential behavior. And one point that we've been thinking about is that one way to understand that is that if the neighboring spins have extremely rapid relaxation rate, then it will no longer look like a so-called like spin. The point is that when you flip the spins, you also flip the neighbors, so you continue to dephase the spins and you get this Gaussian decay. Now, if this thing is being mixed so rapidly by spin lattice relaxation that this 180 degree pulse just doesn't make much difference, then it will look unlike, and you can expect this evolution into the exponential behavior. What it suggests is that...
What is the sample?
Same sample. Lanthanum europium, strontium 0.15. Yes, with europium. So what it suggests is that all of the spins that are visible are coupled to spins that are relaxing very, very rapidly. So rapidly that they're invisible. In other words, it tells you that these are not big blobs again, but the ones that we're seeing, which by low temperatures is a relatively small fraction, the ones that we're seeing apparently are in the near vicinity of very rapidly relaxing spins. So one idea that has occurred to us, and this is a very, I think, simple-minded picture, but is that what we could be looking at are regions, domain, I don't want to use the word domain wall, I don't mean, so just walls or boundaries of differently ordered regions. And here I've suggested stripe ordering, but whatever might be the kind of order that would occur in small regions, you'll have these thin boundaries, and that might be that this is the signal that we can see at low temperatures. This is the remaining signal, and what happens is as a function of temperature, the volume fraction, which is in these boundaries, is shrinking until at low temperatures it vanishes, at least in the samples that we've looked at.
Would there be some saying really boring, like twin boundaries or something, as LTT?
Well, that you don't expect to be so dramatically temperature dependent.
Okay.
There should be the same amount of boundaries. Okay.
Can I ask a question for the previous one? So, does the temperature dependence lies
Of what?
Actually,
depends on line width. Copper line width, it's almost none. I showed that at the beginning. Do you want to?
For this one?
Yeah.
Oh, I see, that's interesting.
It's almost none. With the inhomogeneous line width, of course. Okay, there are a lot of phase diagrams. Simon Billinge and his students have recently published a paper in which they have pointed out the similarity. First of all, they argue that their PDF analysis of neutron scattering data is directly demonstrating bond length disorder, which in turn demonstrates charge inhomogeneity. And it's very definitely a charge probe that they're using. And they've also emphasized or pointed out the relationship between this the spin freezing, as pointed out by in Takashi's work, the correlation with the charge inhomogeneities freezing in their experiments. So what this suggests is that, first of all, the charge and spin are related.
It just before you go on for the line back here, what about this curve shows that line?
These are the data from, these are the data from Simon.
All right, so below that is a line, below that line I see lots of bond length disorder, the black.
Right, well, sort of freezing and bond length disorder, yes.
Which means that it shows up in their experiments, or?
Right, they start to see these.
Okay, so below the black spots I see bond length disorder, then the open symbols are?
This is Takashi's data.
Okay.
According to them, I
so basically all the open symbols we should think of is Takashi's data.
This is due to the resolution of this. This is, I think, muons. This is muon spin.
I'm sorry, we should say spin measurements.
Right.
So the statement is, if one looks at this, then that, you know, a 50% higher temperature. First, as I come down, I start to see charge inhomogeneity as measured by bond length disorder, and then at some lower temperature, I start to see spin freezing.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, if you look at the temperature dependency plot, so the deviation from Einstein curve starts, mm-hmm. that's where they put the point.
Uh-huh.
When this, the broadening increase, that logic was constant.
Ah, I see. Okay, thank you.
This is no European doping, nothing.
No, this is, yeah.
This is lanthanum strontium carbon oxide.
Yeah.
Has some spin freezing on the scale of 100 degrees.
Well, that's what Takashi has shown. Well, I mean, that's my interpretation of Takashi's data. I don't know what he says exactly, but this is from copper wipeout. From Takashi's data on copper wipeout.
But you don't believe copper wipeout.
No, I definitely believe copper wipeout.
No, you had it.
Okay, I'm going to say it one
way. What's your take? I mean, what do you see physically happening there? Suddenly the line width is becoming very broad. What's happening for you?
Spin freezing. What I mean is that your question. What I believe is that there's some slowing of charge dynamics. Now, whether you want to say, you know, that that's the temperature at which they appear, whether you need to say that it's really stripes or it's just, you know, small little segments, little worms, I don't know. But I think it has to do with charged objects becoming pinned to the lattice. That's just my personal opinion, which I think is
some of the open things.
Yes, that's what I think is probably happening, is pinning of some sort of charge objects to the lattice.
Yeah, so just to get a study, right? When you look at spins in 2.4, the story is over at x is 1/8, right?
Yes, the lanthanum strontium 2.4, right. Yes.
Now Mr. Billing is telling us that there's still something in the lattice going on up to 0.15, should we believe that he believes that there is actually a charge warning transition occurring at 0.15?
I don't think
the dark spots are also the spots where there is a structural transition.
No.
That's much higher.
Are you talking about the HT? to LTO transition?
Yeah, that's probably.
Yeah.
But this isn't static. His experiment isn't a static experiment.
No, that's right. It's energy integrated.
So that's not a transition. That all of these crossover.
Yeah, I think that's, and he's not making those kind of. Okay. The point is, I think that this suggests that spin dynamics, in fact, are related to charge dynamics. We have data that I think suggests the same thing, and it's not something that we understand. This is the plot. This is a plot of the copper inverse. 1 over T1T as a function of temperature for two different europium co-dope systems, x equal 1/8 and 0.15. So essentially, very slightly different in doping. This is the x equal 0.15, and this is the 1/8 dope. What I show is open symbols are the same systems without the europium. This is the data from the Kitaoka group. Look essentially the same at high temperatures. The thing that's, of course, very striking is that the 1/8 sample shows very dramatic spin gap kind of behavior, opening at a fairly high temperature, even higher than it does in lanthanum strontium, and very strongly suppressed before recovering and remembering that at the end of the day it's an antiferromagnet rather than a superconductor. In this material you see nothing, and I would propose that one way this could be understood is because the 1/8 you would expect to have commensurate stripes that are commensurate with the lattice, and therefore one could either invoke the fact that this allows much improved pinning of charge stripes to the lattice, or another idea that I think came to me from discussions with Doug, but I think a lot of people have shown that spin ladders produce spin gaps. Now indeed these are not even like ladders, nonetheless one can get partial gapping in the odd leg ladder, so this may have something to do with it. But I think that the fact that commensurate doping is such a big has such a big effect on copper relaxation rate, again, I think is a strong indication that it has to do with charge, and it's not that the spin dynamics are probably very closely coupled to charge dynamics. So I'm going to wrap up. I think this is the main point that I want to leave people with, that the inhomogeneity is very pervasive, and that I believe that it's intrinsic. And the basis for that belief is that it seems to be not related to the extrinsic sources of disorder. Thank you.
But it's clearly an optimal doping.
Pardon me?
At optimal doping, it's freezing at a very low temperature.
In lanthanum strontium cuprate, you're saying? Yes, at least, yes, that's right, as observed by copper wipeout.
So all these...
At optimal doping in the europium, it's still at very high temperature, but that's not... That's an antiferromagnet at low temperatures. Steve?
Yeah, so there's this qualifier, lanthanum cuprate, so what about YBCO or BISCO or...
Okay, I think Charlie will be here next week. I think YBCO is clearly... There's definitely things going on. There's a couple of groups that are saying things about charge density waves based on behavior either of quadrupole resonances.
I mean, do you see the wipeout effect?
We have not looked in that material. I'm not aware of anybody. Oh, wait.
YBCO or BISCO or any other thing besides lanthanum.
I think the Borsa people have seen wipeout in a very lightly doped, about 6 points. Four or something, very lightly.
I mentioned the buzz of the Google. Ah. So like 6.3, 6.4 range, wipeout does happen.
And
but as it doesn't necessarily mean to
what
you
what?
Basically, that's believed to be, apart from inhomogeneity, the non-superconducting part of the phase out of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Charlie Slichter, and I hope I'm assuming he's speaking next week, is showing very clear data, spectral data. So this is completely static measurements, showing that the line widths cannot be understood except in terms of modulations of charge and spin shift. And I think it's very clear data, and the effect is dominant. It's very strong at optimal doping.
Wait, this is in which material? Well,
YBCO, optimally doped, and lanthanum cuprate.
Can
Can I just try a generic argument for your second point?
Yes.
It's often the case that given a sufficient amount of disorder, I don't mean a huge amount, but just, you know, some, on some scale, 10%, then 40% is the same as 10%. So that the fact that it's not so dependent on...
What about in-plane versus out-of-plane? I mean, Wisconsin versus lithium.
Sort of, it seems to me it would depend. I mean, like if you're down at the perturbative level, then you can imagine different kinds of impurities could give you, or different kinds of disorder could give you, you know, distinctively, characteristically different behaviors. But I don't know, this is a really sort of... generic type of argument that may not apply to you.
Then you take lanthanum strontium, and the strontium is distributed inhomogeneously for lanthanum. You consider that not extrinsic disorder, right? In your point of view?
No, just very different from doping in plane or changing the lattice structure. I just consider them all different.
15%.
I agree that it's all. But another argument might make is at that point there's so much of it should be averaged over by some kind of a...
But your scales are also coming down.
No.
Function.
Scales?
His distribution of activation energies was the same. Roughly the same.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Mine, they were essentially independent of...
I guess it could be interesting to... They
lengthen
the helium sulfur oxide and then
dump
the zinc and see if anything happens with the
freezing.
Excellent idea.
You're doing it.
That means he's doing it.
Okay.
Chris, thank you.